Hello and welcome to An Evening with Nirvana. It's a podcast where I'm talking to a series of guests from the Doom community, perhaps outside of it, about level design, map creation, other facets of game development. On this episode of the podcast, I'm talking to Essel Fortium, or Essel Fortium, I guess I'll find out soon, also known as Sarah Mancuso. She's the lead developer of the BTSX series, a contributor to Doom the Way It Did 1 and 2, as well as working on solo projects like Vaporwave for the Eternity Engine and the recently released Knee Deep in ZDoom. She's a MIDI composer, a creator of texture assets, and an all-around staple of the Doom community. She's also composed music for a visual novel that recently came out called Please Be Happy, is working on Supplice, and has an album out that I highly recommend called Future Human. With all that said, welcome to the podcast, Essel.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, exciting stuff. When I was writing the intro, I was like, man, this is going long, because you've just done so much stuff.
It does sound like a lot when you put it all side by side like that.
Yeah, I think, well, I've had a couple of people on who've been in the Doom community for quite a while, but yeah, I think you're one of the OGs, I want to say. I think 2004 is roughly what it had on the wiki, I think, for like your initial release.
I think that's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, oh yeah, it'll be 19 years next year. That is that's a lengthy period of time.
That's kind of terrifying to think about.
Yeah. Well, I guess to go all the way back, what was your very first experience with Doom?
I think I saw it at a friend's house first, because like at home we used Max and there wasn't a version of Doom for that for like another year or so. Mm-hmm. So I saw it at a friend's house, but I was just like immediately mesmerized with it. I had to have been around like 5 or 6, I guess. And then when it finally came out for Mac, I got the shareware version, and it was impossible to pull me away from it as soon as I figured out how to get out of the demo loop.
Right.
And I just remember having to, like, convince my parents to get the full game for me because they were concerned because it was violent and everything. And I just remember being like, well, if you don't, I'm just going to keep playing the demo anyway. And I think that they just gave in.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, so this was original Doom. Do you remember when you got like Doom 2, Final Doom, was that much later or were they like around sort of the release time?
I know I got Doom 2 as like the first full Doom game that I had, and then I got Final Doom and Ultimate Doom sometime later.
Mm-hmm. And which of the iWords was your favorite, or like which one resonated the most with you?
I think I honestly just loved all of them at that point, but I remember being like really impressed with some of the areas in the first few maps of TNT, just like some of the scenes in it. Mm-hmm. Though back then I was a really terrible player. Like I didn't know how to strafe or run yet. So I just kind of used cheats and explored a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's definitely a common thread, I think. I mean, I definitely couldn't strafe. I remember I had to, like, if you wanted to dodge a projectile, you had to like turn your camera and move backwards, which made Revenants pretty painful to deal with.
Yeah, it was tough. I remember playing on easy skill and still having a hard time.
I think I still played on UV. Like, I, as a kid, I was basically the people that would then go on to frustrate me when I would make maps, and they would only play on Ultraviolence and get really mad. So, you know.
Yeah, I know a few people like that. I'm not going to name any names.
Name and shame at this point. No, not really. Don't do that. People will be upset in the YouTube comments. A lot of people sort of, they play the iWords and stuff and then they take a big break and then they come back to Doom. Did you get into PWODs relatively quickly or did you take like a substantial break and then come back to the community?
I got into PWODs pretty early because like I found some shovelware CD that had a whole bunch of Doom WODs and some demos of other early FPS games. I think it was called Virtual Realities or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember a lot of what was on it. I remember it had Simpsons Doom, of course.
Yep.
It had a bunch of things that didn't actually work on the Mac version of Doom. So I was always just like, what's this? This is so mysterious. And then I found out later that they were like terrible. But then like it was a few years later that I got into what was actually being posted online and seeing stuff like Batman Doom that was really eye-opening for like what people were able to do with Doom. That kind of just blew me away.
Wow, Batman Doom. I haven't thought about Batman Doom in a very long time, but I do remember it for sure. Do you remember, like, what the first P was that were actually kind of influential, I guess? Like, ones that made you want to get into making your own stuff?
Honestly, I think I wanted to make my own stuff, like, as soon as I touched the game, pretty much. I was the kind of kid who would always, like, if there was any way that I could modify a game, like change out the graphics in it or edit the levels or anything like that, I would usually end up spending more time doing that than I would actually playing it.
Mm-hmm. So was Doom your first, like the first game that you made custom content for, or had you like tried modding other games before that?
I don't really remember the exact timeline, but I know that I had done some Wolfenstein mapping, and then I had done like some attempts at my own game development with stuff like HyperCard, but I got into Doom mapping around 1999 or 2000 when I was 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's pretty early. I mean, I suppose it was quite early for me too. I definitely started when I was a kid. Were you using something like DoomCAD 95, which is what I used? Did you have a very difficult time working with the editor back then?
I was using an editor called Hellmaker, which was a Mac-only thing. I remember it crashed a lot, but it also had some pretty like forward-thinking features, like things that showed up in Doom Builder 2 like a decade later.
Wow. Yeah. DoomCAD did not have forward-thinking features.
Yeah, well, I've never used DoomCAD. I remember trying briefly DU because there was a port of it, and I just remember being so confused at like how to do anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah, DoomCAD was very crash heavy for sure. It did sort of, I don't know about, I think there was like DoomCAD 97 or something. There was like a slightly better version that came out a bit later, but the one that I used sort of claimed to have a visual mode, but every time I tried to load it up, it crashed. So
that's a good feature.
It was pretty good, yeah. Really, really taught me a lot. I will say though, working in those old editors, because you had to input every number manually, like if you wanted to change brightness or height or whatever, you couldn't just go into visual mode and change it that way. You had to actually know, like, okay, a Cyberdemon's this tall, I need to make the room this tall. So it did teach me like a lot about what like height and width the monsters were, and how big a room should look compared to its like number size and things like that. So there was some use out of using those old editors for sure.
Yeah, it definitely made you like think more about, I don't know, I guess it made you think more about what you were doing, but it was, I don't know if I would say that was for the better.
Right. Well, it taught you patience, maybe a little bit as well.
Like my earliest Doom mapping stuff though was like, I had basically no concept of what was or wasn't possible in Doom, especially like in the vanilla game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when I was 10, I wanted to, a friend and I were going to make a original game using Doom, and it was going to be called Mischief Night 2000, and it was about like running from the cops and like throwing toilet paper at houses and shit like that. And it was like, I have no idea how this was going to work in Doom, but at the time I didn't know.
Yeah, I think back then it was just way harder anyway with those old editors to like create the things you wanted to. I feel like now much easier to come in and come up with some sort of semblance of what you want with Doom Builder. 'Cause I think visual mode is just such a massive thing, being able to go in and see it coming together as you build.
Absolutely.
So speaking of your earliest works, the earliest one that I could find was from Sarge Baldy, his speed mapping project. I'm not sure, I'm not aware of who Sarge Baldy is, but maybe you can enlighten me. It was a very small sort of early map of yours. Do you remember creating it? Do you feel like you learned a lot sort of getting a map sort of built for the first time? If it was, in fact, your first time.
I think I had been away from Doom for a year or two when I made that, and I was just starting to get back into it. It wasn't my first map. Like, I had made a bunch of maps for... I actually had a project on Doomworld in 2002 when I was 12, where I had roped a bunch of people, and somehow I got a few people to help me out with this. Like, I wanted to do a Doom Bible remake thing, because that's like what seemingly everybody wants to do when they're starting out and doesn't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't very good, but that was closer to my first maps that I can remember. As far as the Sarge Baldy speed mapping thing, though, I don't remember a whole lot other than just that I ran into some sort of mapping errors and I was struggling to get anything submitted during, like, within the time limit.
Right. Well, it's interesting to come back and then do a speed mapping thing, because I feel like I was a little too scared to do speed mapping until I knew my way around the editor a bit more and was a bit more confident.
Yeah, I think I was a bit overly confident there, and that kind of showed me, like, okay, there's definitely more that I have to learn here.
Uh-huh. The next thing I saw was, I think it was just called Essel Map 1 Testing Facility, I think. And it's sort of E1-esque, but there's already, like, a pretty, like, compared to the Sarge Baldy speed map, for instance, there's, like, quite a high level of detail. There's, like, good lighting gradient usage, lots of interconnectivity in the map design. I was wondering at this time, like, what kind of stuff were you looking at for inspiration, and like, what did you really enjoy playing?
What I was actually playing, I can't really remember that much. I mean, I know that there was some influence from just, like, E1, or at least what I had remembered of E1. It's like, one thing that I remember focusing on a lot in that level was really complex secrets, like multi-layered secrets I was having fun making. But, like, I think my influences were actually changing a lot as I was working on it, because it was my first, like, really ambitious map, and I was taking a while with it, and I was still learning at the time. So from one area to the next, it kind of changes in style a bit. Like, the lighting totally changes. But I know that at some points I was looking at, like, the Realm 667 detail guide. At some points I was looking at, like, simplicity. At other points I was just looking at screenshots of other cool stuff that people were making at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I made a note here that very smugly I SR50'd to the exit, so you might want to go back and patch that.
Yeah, somebody figured that out, like, basically immediately after I realized, after I released the map, and I didn't really know much about speed running at the time, and I was kind of disappointed.
Yeah, that's always brutal. I remember making I think my first actual public release was, like, a GZ Doom map, and it allowed jumping. And I did not realize how busted jumping was. So the map was broken like 50 times instantly as soon as anybody tested it. It was great fixing all that.
Oh no.
Jumping with an SR50, you can cover, like, I don't know, some absurd amount of units. Like over 256 map units or something crazy. I don't know how you possibly balance jumping in Doom, but there you go. I wanted to talk just a little bit about the 32 and 24 projects, because if you go to your Doom Wiki page, about 80% of it is 32 and 24 maps, I feel like. Just a huge number of maps, and spanning both single-player and multiplayer maps across, like, multiple years. What attracted you to the projects initially, and why do you think it is that you sort of keep coming back and really enjoy making maps for it?
I think it was just like one day Shaikotan showed up on Doomworld and was like, let's see if we can make a whole megawatt in 24 hours. And I hadn't seen anybody else attempt something like that before. And it was just a fun challenge to be part of it. It was my first time seriously attempting deathmatch mapping. So I definitely learned a lot from that, like just from the first few sessions of that, kind of getting more and more into that groove and figuring out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say in general, it was just a fun way to make something without a whole lot of pressure, though the later installments did get more involved. And for those, I ended up like making fewer and fewer maps because each one was taking more time, I think.
Yeah, that seems to always be the case. Did you find that like making multiplayer maps helped your single player map making in terms of like, I feel like multiplayer maps usually very interconnected and have a lot of looping sort of design choices. Did you find that that was useful?
I would say so, definitely. Like, one thing that sticks in my mind sometimes, like when I'm stuck on a layout, is I will think of, I'm pretty sure it was Mechadon who said this years ago, that he kind of thinks of his single player layouts as like several deathmatch arenas.
That's interesting. Especially for Mechadon, because well, I guess it would be more than several arenas to my mind. Like he makes very large maps, I guess.
Yeah, just that his areas, because he started out as a deathmatch mapper, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of his single player maps are kind of like, it's a similar approach, but just expanded out a lot and with more of them strung together. But that you've just got these interlocking paths that are just fun to run around in, like at different heights, all interconnected. And so when I get stuck on a single player map that I'm working on, I think like, okay, well, what can I build here that would be fun in deathmatch that I can turn into something for single player?
Right. Yeah, it's probably a good way to think for arena design, like for encounters and stuff. Creating that kind of more circuit focus loop. Map one of Fractured Worlds was kind of built with that philosophy of having it be like a full circuit that was all interconnected. And I think just building shapes in that way and having that in mind of like, well, if I've built this shape here, I might as well connect it to this shape here, I think is like a pretty good habit for like constructing early map flow when designing levels.
Definitely.
So because you sort of joined the 32 and 24 quite early, did you feel like it helped sort of your style develop through the maps?
I would say so, yeah. Like, I definitely learned more about mapping and making layouts from making those and from studying what other people were making for 32 and 24.
Hmm. Was there a lot of playtesting between people in the projects?
In the early sessions, no. In the later sessions, yeah. But just even in the early sessions, though, there were a bunch of like pretty great mappers who were showing up and making things. So, you know, just like getting introduced to people like Mechadon and just getting to see what they were doing was definitely influential.
Mm-hmm. Was Mechadon already sort of known at that point? Had he already been making like bigger releases and stuff? I'm not actually sure.
I think he had started out making, or I might be completely misremembering, but I think he started out making things for Skull Tag. So it was like deathmatch related stuff. And then he kind of slid into single player stuff from there.
Mm-hmm. I think Skillsaw had a similar trajectory. I'm not sure if it was actually a Skull Tag, but he definitely made a lot of like multiplayer GZ Doomy stuff, I think, before his early projects, I believe.
I know that Skillsaw had done a map set in around like the early 2000s or maybe even the late 90s that I have not played. And then I know that he came back and did some Z Doom stuff and then got into like Boom and Limit Removing and Vanilla stuff, but I don't know if I've played any multiplayer stuff from him. I might just have missed it, though.
I think... Well, you know, I shouldn't... I literally interviewed him and talked about this, so you'd think I would remember it in detail, but... I think I would now be speculating a little bit. But I think it might have been sort of like the more Invasion-style stuff, if I remember correctly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did a few maps in Stronghold.
That's right, Stronghold, yep. That was it.
And I think those were... I think that was actually my first exposure to Skillsaw's maps, and I just remember, like... I had very mixed feelings on Stronghold as a whole, but his were definitely some of the maps that really stood out to me. Like, okay, there's something interesting here. Like, he had done, like, a tropical island beach map, I remember, and then there was some, like... Aurora map. There was some interesting stuff there.
Yeah, I remember finding like Stronghold maps and stuff as a like when I first got back into Doom, but like I could only like open them and like walk around in them. I couldn't figure out how the hell you were meant to play them. Like I had no idea how you play these maps. So I remember being really impressed with like the visuals and stuff and wanting to play them, but I was like, I don't know how to play this, so I never actually got to try it. I guess just talking about community projects in general, do you think that they're generally sort of the best way for new mappers to get started if they don't know what to make, rather than leaping in and being like, I'm going to make a mega wad by myself, which a lot of people mistakenly do, I think?
It's definitely a better idea than trying to leap in and make a mega wad when you don't really know what you're doing yet, because that was... a lesson that I definitely learned a few times early on.
Right.
But, I mean, I was lucky that 32 and 24 ended up being the kind of project that I could grow with, because, like, with each installment, it got kind of more ambitious. Mm-hmm. I would say that, like, for somebody new to mapping who's looking for someplace to get started, a community project that's led by somebody who can give good feedback is definitely a good way to go if you're going that route. Route.
Yeah. I jump between route and route myself. Like I say router, but I say route. So, you know, a bit all over the place. I think British people actually just say router, which I don't know how I feel about. Yeah, they call it a router because they say route instead of route.
It's unacceptable.
Yeah, it's a wild ride, the English language. Doom the way you did, what interested you in the idea of, like, building maps in the style of the Eye Awards? Did you still have some of that E1 M1 love that you wanted to, get out into the world?
Definitely, and I think I also just like weird design challenges sometimes, like, trying to follow some arbitrary set of rules to make something, just... sometimes I find that more inspiring than having complete freedom.
Right. And did you find that there were, like, specific challenges you had in trying to mimic the style of, like, the id developers?
I would say one thing that I had issues with was getting the scale right, and I, a lot of the times, did not really succeed when I went back and compared with some of the original maps, but... another thing definitely was just coming up with like a good and plausible E1 M1, especially the opening shot. That was something that I was really focused on trying to get just right, because I feel like Doom has such an iconic opening shot that like conveys so many things about what separates Doom from Wolfenstein.
Right.
And so I wanted to really try to capture that without copying it, and that was challenging.
Yeah, because I guess like, right off the bat, you have, like, height differential, and then the window to the outside, there's an outside space, there's a skybox. I think you can see, like, the pool of liquid, too, and then there's, like, a lot of different lighting contrasts between, which Wolfenstein didn't have, so, yeah, there's a lot going on. Yeah. And I'm wondering, like, between, Doom the way it did 1 and 2, did you find that there were like some pretty major differences between the way maps were created for Doom 1 and for Doom 2 when you took a look at them?
Well, to be fair, with the first Doom the way it did, we were like very much just winging it and going by feel, whereas Doom 2 the way it did had a lot more actual research going on. But I would say that Doom 2's maps tend to be a lot more vertical and experimental, whereas Doom 1 tends to be more like corridors and dungeon crawler kind of stuff.
That's interesting. I definitely think of Doom 1 as, like Sandy Peterson talked a little bit about how he liked to like build suspense in his maps and how that was kind of important. But I feel like suspense, to me, felt a lot more important in Doom 1 rather than Doom 2, which feels definitely like it leaned much more into like the action elements of Doom.
Yeah, that makes sense. Doom 2 definitely is more focused on the action side of things.
I guess map... I suppose... Is it called the Focus map 5? I think it's the Focus.
Map 4?
That's map 4. God. My IWOD knowledge is definitely disappearing daily. But map 5 is like pretty suspenseful and tricks and traps as well, I suppose. So there are definitely some maps in there. But then there's a Cyber Demon in a room full of Barons, so is it that suspenseful? I don't know.
Not very, no. But it's fun, and I guess that's what they were, you know, that's what it's about.
So for Doom the way you did too, you did like a lot more studying of the maps and stuff. What was the actual process like then when you were trying to build a map for the project?
The actual process was, I would say, at least for me, I still tended to go by feel a lot, except just with more documentation to kind of guide me in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. So it was pretty similar to like your normal mapping process, just with some notes to look at.
Yeah, so, I mean, I usually, with the Doom the way it did stuff, I was generally aiming for mimicking the style of one mapper or the other. So, like, for instance, God, I'm trying to remember what was the name of some of these, but, like, Dead Sea is a style, like, a Sandy Peterson map where it's, like, a exploration sandbox kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then Leap of Faith was more aimed at being a John Romero map, though actually when I started that one I was originally aiming for a Sandy Peterson and kind of decided like, okay, this is going in a much more Romero direction, so I decided to just not fight it.
Right. What I mean, I suppose for anyone who doesn't know, what would you say are sort of the major differences between like a Sandy Peterson map and a Romero map?
I would say a Sandy Peterson map tends to involve more like isolated concepts that are just then connected together almost, I don't want to say like an afterthought because that sounds mean, but just like,
right,
that they're more about the individual concepts, whereas the Romero maps tend to be more like, here's a complete place and it all kind of relates to the same idea more.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Sandy is just like, here are a whole bunch of cool ideas.
Right. Just couldn't contain them all. Had to put them in one map.
Yes. And the Romero maps also, especially from like Doom 2 and Episode 4, there tended to be a lot of like catwalks over damage floor and just hubs around that kind of structure.
Right. Well, yeah, I suppose E4 M8, right? That was the other one he made.
He did E4 M2 and E4 M6.
Oh, it's 6. See, my Iowa knowledge terrible once again.
Yeah.
But E4 M6 is probably my favorite, one of my favorite IWOD maps in general. I really like that map. That is,
That's a really cool map, and it feels kind of like the culmination of all of Romero's accumulated experience with making levels for Doom.
It definitely feels like a little ahead of its time in a way. like the layout, the way it's structured, built around the central area, and then I don't know, the use of the cyber demon, and there's a lot of things in there that I feel like the rest of the iWad levels weren't really doing very well. I don't know. I feel like it just has like a lot of interesting concepts that I feel like you see later on in PWOD designs, but weren't necessarily done very much in the iWads.
Yeah, definitely.
So, well, moving on to, I guess, what would be considered the big one, back to Saturn X. I'm curious what the original concept for BTSX was, and what were, like, the early conversations about the WOD like?
Well, it started out pretty small. Like, I had been making a few texture WODs and just sort of dipping my toes into making textures. And then at some point I played Darkening 2 again, and I got really inspired to make something for vanilla, because just like with all the new resources in the Darkening episode 2, to me it was like, whoa, this feels almost like a new game, and it runs in the original EXE. That's really cool. And at the same time, though, like, I didn't want to set my sights too high, because I had really struggled with leading team projects up to that point, like just getting stuff together and getting things moving. So my original plan was really, I was just going to like get a few friends to make some maps to go with the resources, and I might do like a map or two or something.
Right.
And that was going to be it.
Yeah, so it started off as quite a small thing, and then it really got out of control.
Yeah.
I think you, from what I saw, you worked on 13 of the maps for BTSX Episode 1, and you made MIDI for 10 of them as well, and then you, as well as the intermission screen, and then textures on top of that. Were you planning to do all of this when the project began? Like, did you know you were going to make MIDI for it and make maps for it and do all this stuff?
Definitely not. I mean, like I was saying, I was originally just planning on doing some textures and maybe like two maps, because I had always been a pretty slow mapper. And so I was like, I don't want to overstretch myself. I don't want to end up working on this for the next 10 years, which of course may have happened. But
yeah.
Then just like, as the project snowballed and just continued to grow in size, I ended up doing more and more for it. Like, there was a lot of collaborative mapping where I would take either a partially finished map by someone or a map that didn't really quite fit into vanilla limits, and I would do some work on that. And then I ended up doing several maps on my own for it. So yeah, I definitely ended up doing a lot more than expected. As far as the music goes, like, I had been doing music for a long time, but not really for Doom before. So I had been in a rut musically, just like I was not really feeling anything that I had been doing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried just writing MIDIs as a change of pace, and I got really into it and ended up writing a ton of stuff.
Right. And were you using MIDI already for like compositional purposes or anything, or did you have to learn that like for BTSX?
I had not been making like MIDI files, but I had been using a MIDI sequencer.
Okay. And what do you like, what instrument or instruments do you play generally?
I play keyboard a little bit, not really very well, but just enough to get ideas sketched down.
Okay. Interesting. Because, yeah, I know, I think Rubix had used MIDI, like, for his guitar as, like, a compositional tool, I believe. So it's always interesting hearing how people get into using MIDI sequences and things, because it seems to start in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I did not know that he was using a MIDI guitar.
So could you talk a little bit sort of creating the texture theme for the WOD, and when the palette was developed? Did you also do the palette work, or did that come later from someone else?
I did also do the palette work. That came much later, and it was kind of just a series of gradual changes. Like, I just, at first, I just had the standard vanilla palette. Then I did the usual, like, oh, well, Doom palettes usually change the blues and the greens just because you can mess with them without breaking anything else.
Yeah.
And then I changed the purples, and then ended up finding a way, you know, like finding empty spaces in the palette. Well, not empty, but stealable spots in the palette that I could use to expand the purple from Doom's original 5 magentas into, I think it's like 16 purples in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then also like adjusting the reds so that they would fade more nicely into black, that kind of stuff.
And how how did all of that go? Learning all of that, because people may think this sounds pretty easy, like, oh, you're just changing one color to another color, how hard can that be? But people choose the blues and greens for a reason. They're very easy to work with. You just change the whole range and it doesn't really affect too much, apart from a few pixels in the darker green ranges on some stuff that can cause you problems. But if you change the red range, it's very difficult, because a lot of things are made up of like the pink range and two separate red ranges, so you end up with like a lot of weird stuff going on. Did you have like any particular challenges working on the palette?
I would say the trickiest part was just figuring out what I could and couldn't steal from the palette without breaking things.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, I mean, BTSX remaps all of the original sprites to fit its palette just because it changes way too much to be able to work with the original graphics. But yeah, even then, just like editing the color map can be very fiddly, because you can end up with something that looks like a really minor change, and then you try it out in the game and it's like, oh god, everything is like turning weird colors now.
Yeah. And also, you, because it's for a vanilla project, you obviously would have been working with software for the most part, and that can have some problems with like shadow ranges and things in the color map too, I think. I don't know if you ran into any of that.
So generally, like, I would say most of the WADs that I've released are primarily intended for software rendering. Mm-hmm. And in BTSX, you get some nice special effects in software, like how the colors blue and green kind of like blue, green, and orange all, they do a U-shifting thing, like where the color changes a bit as it gets darker or gets into the distance.
Yeah.
Whereas in hardware rendering, it just gets darker instead of shifting like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there are a lot of subtle differences with software in NGL, but I feel like the more that I've mapped and the more that certain people have yelled at me to use software, the more I've realized that I just feel personally that it just looks better in Doom, but that's just me.
I mean, I feel like it looks better for things that are made for it, and then just, like,
yeah,
you know, there are a lot of things, people are doing, like, ridiculous stuff in Doom with hardware rendering that, like, you couldn't really approach in software, but,
mm-hmm,
I don't know, software is comfy, I like it.
Yeah, I do, I would say that GL is much better if you want, like, an all-purpose renderer for Doom. It will do a better job on most things, I think. But yeah, stuff that's built for software looks just better in software. I'm curious with BTSX. Oh, actually, if you wanted to, I did want to sort of hear about the development of the textures for the ward, because I'm really interested in that aspect of it. Was that all sort of like hand-created textures? Were they patches ripped from other games and edited? Or how did you sort of end up building
stuff? All of the textures in BTSX are made from scratch. I didn't want to use anything from other games or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of inspiration taken from Quake 2, Darkening Episode 2, and Doom 64 for the first episode of BTSX. But yeah, everything was pretty much done in Photoshop.
Right. And do you have like a visual arts background as well? Or was this something you were sort of just sort of learned as a hobby?
It was just something that I learned as a hobby, pretty much.
Interesting. That's pretty impressive, because those textures look good.
Some of them took a lot of revisions over time before episode one actually came out, because just some of them looked pretty terrible in the early versions.
Right. The beta like in builds. The
early dev builds, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like stuff can look really good in, like, Slade or, you know, whatever the equivalent is. And then when you get it in-game, sometimes the way the lighting plays off and stuff, sometimes it just does not look how you thought it would look, I guess.
That's true, yeah. But, I mean, there was also just, like, nacho cheese lava.
Right. I feel like there are a lot of ones that have nacho cheese lava, though. And wear it proudly as a badge of honor. I think Mayhem Orange had, like, very spicy Dorito lava, if I remember correctly.
Sounds good.
So, I wanted to ask about the train station hub maps. Where did the idea for these come from? Just having these sort of, like, little intermission areas to walk around in.
Well, after we split things up from, because it was originally going to be just one big WOD, and then we ended up with more maps than we knew what to do with, so we had to split it up into multiple episodes. And so the idea of the train station hubs was basically just to fill in more map slots so that because the secret exit has to be on map 15 in vanilla, and we didn't want to have that be like all the way at the very end. Yeah, so right. We thought, okay, it would be cool to have like some sort of recurring hub thing to give it a theme, I guess. And a train station just seemed like a cool thing to do with that.
Mm-hmm. And did, what about the, like, the tone of those maps? They're sort of these somber little walk around areas. Was that just sort of decided during the mapping process, or did you know that you wanted like kind of a tonal shift between maps?
That's a good question. I feel like part of the minimalism with it just came from like it was one of the last things that I finished for episode one.
Right.
The simplistic style for it, just, you know, like this empty train station, just it just seemed to work really well.
Right. And in terms of, like, composing MIDI and stuff in general, I was wondering if you could talk about, like, the different beats you wanted to hit, because there's sort of, like, the ambient music of the hubs and then various different tones for the maps. What was the process like making MIDI for the project?
So for the hub maps, the ambient music for that, the track Waiting, that was Dew's idea. Dew is our lead playtester for BTSX, and just he linked me to a track from, was it XCOM or something like that, and it was just this nice ambient thing, and I was like, okay, I can do something along those lines, and I sort of just did my own take on that. But as far as the other music, I was kind of just writing tons of music and just seeing where it would fit in later.
Right.
I would say the only tracks that were really written in E1, the only tracks that were written with specific map slots in mind, for me at least, was Entering for the first map and Waiting for the hub maps.
Right.
With Entering, like we had another MIDI there as a sort of placeholder, but it was too repetitive and it got complaints from some of the mappers. But it had some traces of a mood that I liked, even though it was also a lot heavier than Entering. But there was just something in there that I wanted to try to capture in Entering.
Huh. Yeah, I'm always interested in like the MIDI composing process for different people. But I guess it sounds like you were just kind of on a big creative run with making MIDI, so you just had a lot of stuff that you wanted to use.
Yeah, I was just going for it, I guess.
Right. I've asked I sort of every time I talk to people who've worked on BTSX, I'm always curious about their experience personally with dealing with the vanilla limitations. It sounds like you had vanilla limitations in mind when you started the project. So I'm curious if you were like very mentally prepared to handle these plane overflows and things.
I mean, you're never really fully prepared to have to, you know, like there's always some unfortunate surprise that's like, oh yeah, I've got this area all done, and now I just realized that if I look from this angle, I can see like three different scenes at once, and now everything is exploding. But I would say, like, even though they can be frustrating sometimes, like, one thing that we learned while working on BTSX was that there are ways that you can adapt your mapping style to be more efficient. And so, I don't know, I was always looking for ways of making things that would look cool while fitting nicely into limits. I think I just like weird technical challenges, honestly.
Right. Did you find...
like?
Oh, sorry, you go.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, no, you go. It's fine. I was going to sort of move into another thing.
But just one thing that happened with BTSX with vanilla limits was like taking a map that doesn't really work in vanilla and turning it into one that does, but like not just by cutting things out of it, but by redesigning it to make it basically feel like it was made that way in the first place.
Uh-huh.
And that was called, like, we called that shadow porting just because of the first map of BTSX E2 that had that done to it. Shadow port.
Is that, like, quite a challenge, trying to restructure maps to function in vanilla?
It can definitely take some... It can definitely take some thought sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Just figuring out what you can cut out that's not really going to harm it, and then, like, what you can put in to replace those things that's going to make it still cool.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that working with vanilla limitations made you, like, a better mapper in terms of making the most out of the space that you have and you know, making the most with, making more with less, I suppose?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, just approaching maps in that way and having to do that shadow porting process, like, it definitely got me thinking about, like, okay, while I'm in here making this work for vanilla, what can I do to streamline the layout? Or, like, how can I solve these problems?
Yeah. And what were the conversations about, like, regarding difficulty for the WOD? Were you just sort of aiming for it to be a little bit more of a challenge than Plutonia, for instance, so that people who'd play the iWODs would sort of get something out of it, or were there sort of big discussions about difficulty at all?
Honestly, early on in development, I was never really sure how to answer that question. I think I used to just tell people, like, well, somewhere around the early Alien Vendetta, but then as the project got bigger and we started getting more and more maps, we started seeing more difficult maps too.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't sort of like a strict cutoff for difficulty necessarily. It was more just how it felt during testing and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely some cases where, like, you know, some cases where a map would need to get punched up some to make it more difficult, and other cases where it was like, okay, I think that if we leave this as is, it's just going to, like, make everyone mad.
Right.
Maybe not everyone mad, but a lot of people mad.
Anonymous people doing id games reviews.
I don't know. I guess that's not really a good way to describe it, because honestly, I was less concerned with what random people thought than just, like, I just wanted to make something that I could enjoy.
Right. I think that's, yeah, generally the best way to map, honestly. I did want to talk specifically about creating map 25, the unsinkable Fats Domino. Obviously, I suppose you had some sort of story thread throughout. When did the concept of, like, sinking into the water come up, and how did you go about sort of making that work?
So because episode 2 started with Shadowport, where you've, like, apparently swum to shore, swam, swum, swum to shore. So I thought that it would be a fun way to end E1 by having your boat sink and then just, you know, there you are just sinking.
Yeah.
So as far as how to make it work, like, do you mean the technical aspects of it or?
Yeah, the technical aspects of it.
Really, the most of it was really just making some custom textures, just like silhouette of an upside down boat and some crates and then like some blue backdrops and bubbles and stuff.
Right. So you it came together pretty quickly, really.
I would say so. Yeah, I mean, like, as Dew likes to say, ship posting is the reward for completing the rest of the project. So it was just a fun thing to do at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always thought it was really cool. Definitely. I don't know if I would say it's the highlight of the WOD, but maybe it is. I really like sort of things that you don't necessarily expect in Doom. You know, you play enough WODs, you are generally just sort of looking out for the most interesting aspects, and I really thought that was a cool way to end it. So for BTSX 2, you made map 1 for BTSX 1, and you also made it for 2. I'm curious if you had any particular thoughts on, like, what makes a good map 1 for a WOD.
Well, I should say both of those maps were collaborations. Like,
sure,
map right. 1 and episode 1 was me and Tarnsman, and we were, in that case, we were pretty much like working side by side on that.
Mm-hmm.
But then map 1 of episode 2 was me adapting a map by Joshi for Vanilla Limits and like streamlining its layout flow.
Right.
But I would say that as far as what makes a good map 1, like, I feel like one thing that at least I try to do is having some iconic scenes that you can recognize immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I like looping layouts where you can get a good sense of the space, like E1M1 in Doom.
Right, yeah. So, simple map flow and memorable spaces. And I guess you talked about sort of wanting a good opening shot as well earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, Shadowport is definitely not a simple layout, but I think it's, I don't know, just like, as soon as I saw it, I was like, this has to go in here. This has to be, we have to make this work. Because it was right. Just such a cool map and such a cool opener that Joshi submitted. And so we just had to figure out how to make it work for Vanilla.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I guess thinking about it, it's not really a simple map. It's very, it's actually quite complex layout-wise, and does have a great establishing shot. It does a lot of things well, that map. It's a cool one. Were there any discussions initially when BTSX 2 was being concocted? Were there discussions about things that you wanted to improve on after seeing sort of, I mean, what was ultimately a very positive reaction to BTSX 1, but there must have been some things that you guys wanted to do differently.
Well, it's kind of a common misconception that E2 was started after E1, because they were more or less developed simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, E1 had a bit of a head start from 2009, but it was mostly dead in that time, and, like, E2 started sometime in 2011, which was not long after E1 started to really snowball.
Right.
So, just like, we were definitely conscious of the critiques that E1 got, but we kind of always knew that E1's narrow focus on tech-themed maps was going to be a bit odd to people without having the context of E2 yet. Because, like, we had all these varied adventure maps in, like, all these different themes, but all that was released yet was the tech episode, and so we were kind of pigeonholed for a while into that one style.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also why an update of E1 added Bingo Pool Hall of Blood by Tarnsman and I and Optical Hopscotch by Skillsaw, because we definitely wanted to just, like, find ways of breaking things up some more.
Right, yeah. And was there some kind of story and episode layout predetermined before starting the WoD in order, like, I guess I was thinking about things like texture creation and stuff to make that easier. Or did you just sort of end up making textures upon request?
Honestly, I was mostly just making textures as ideas came to me. Like, I would say the one thing, though, was that Torn Kimbach, who worked on map 2 of episode 1 with me, he at some point requested some gothic textures. And at first I was really hesitant because I knew that it would expand the project scope so much from what was originally just like, let's make a Darkening 2 tribute.
Mm-hmm.
Except, you know, that was kind of the spark that ignited episode 2 and, you know, episodes 2 and 3 happening.
Right. I would imagine you had, like, so you probably had, like, the story ideas quite early, I would think. I'm thinking, I suppose, of BTSX1, and then you said you had these train hub maps to sort of flesh out the Megawad because of the secret exit thing. But,
as far as the story and episode layout and stuff goes, like, we really just, like, I think I mentioned, but we just had too many maps to fit in 1 megawatt after a while. And so I think it was Zazer helped figure out, like, how we should split things up to, so, okay, we have the tech episode on the light side of the planet, then, like, the ruins and gothic episode on the dark side of the planet. And then we had some maps that didn't really fit with either of those themes. And so that was the genesis of episode 3, where you are like trapped in between dimensions.
So there was sort of like a bit of an undercurrent of story there, I guess.
But it was kind of after a lot of the E1 and E2 mapping was already done.
Right. Okay. For the MIDI composing for BTSX episode 2, did you already have a bunch of MIDI then still just like lying around because you'd had this big sort of creative spell of making all this stuff, or did you have to do like a lot of composition again?
Well, yeah, a lot of the E2 MIDIs are from the same time that I was working on the E1 MIDIs. Like, actually, some of the MIDIs that I have in E3 are older than any of those.
Right. I mean, that must be good to just have, like, this big pool of stuff to be able to draw from. But,
definitely, yeah.
Did you find that, like, there were certain maps where you were like, oh, this kind of needs a very specific composition that you would then sort of make something more catered to how the map felt?
Yeah. I think, I'm trying to remember, I think Lost City from the map Dirty Water and Ether from the map Speed Traps for the Bee Kingdom, those two I'm pretty sure were written for those specific map slots.
Right. So, moving on from BTSX, you only made one map for it, but I did want to touch on Ancient Aliens. I noticed in your BTSX maps and in your map for Ancient Aliens that you seem to prefer giving the rocket launcher away early and then letting the player sort of find the SSG later on. You generally prefer like rocket launcher gameplay, or is it done more as a way to like structure the map with a more unique weapon progression?
That's interesting that you noticed that, because I don't think I've really noticed that pattern.
Right.
I think I was just self-conscious about being too typical with progression, but apparently I was just falling into my own patterns.
Well, it's definitely not a 100% of the time thing, but definitely there are quite a few maps in BTSX where there's like a decent amount of early rocket gameplay. And then when I played your Ancient Aliens map again, because I replayed it for the podcast, and yeah, then it was mostly rocket launcher as well, and then you get the SSG a bit later on. So yeah, I thought it was interesting. But generally, I don't know. People do definitely tend to give you the SSG straight away, and then it's a lot of SSGing mid-tiers, so it can be refreshing, I think, to get the rocket launcher instead.
Yeah, I like to just let the other weapons have a chance to shine, because definitely once you have the SSG, it can kind of fall into just like, this is the only weapon that I need now.
Yeah, definitely. I was curious, do you tend to do, like, a lot of layout sketching and pre-planning for your maps? Or do you like, block things out with no texturing, or do you just sort of start building and then see where it goes?
Honestly, it varies a lot. I don't usually do actual sketches, but my Ancient Aliens map is definitely one case where I blocked things out with just placeholder textures first, and several of my BTS XC3 maps started out that way too.
Right. So you don't necessarily have like a strict way that you map. It's more dependent on what you're mapping for, kind of thing.
I think so. I mean, I tend towards the simple block out layout first approach more recently than I used to. Because I found that I can get a lot more ambitious with the layout when I'm starting with like just the layout and not having to worry about detailing and texturing yet, just because I can iterate on things a lot more easily mm-hmm. without having to worry about like, well, I've already detailed this scene, but now I want to like knock down those walls, change the shape of this. And because, you know, then it's like, but I'd have to get rid of all that work.
Yeah.
Whereas if I've just got the layout, then it's really easy to just mess with things.
Yeah, and I think I would imagine that having worked on BTSX and taking other people's maps and kind of changing them and touching them up here and there probably would have helped with that kind of thing, because I think that taking like a layout structure and then adding detail after the fact and stuff is like a different skill to me than building it as you go.
Yeah, it can be kind of challenging sometimes. Like, I remember it took me a while to figure out exactly how I wanted to theme my Ancient Aliens map, just because I had it all laid out with, like, stock Doom 2 textures, and the Ancient Aliens resource was just, like, there was so much cool stuff in it, and I couldn't really figure out yet, like, exactly what I wanted to do there.
Right. Yeah, I was sort of curious if the, like, the palette and the texture assets are like a huge part of your mapping process. Like, Ancient Aliens has like a very distinct palette, very distinct assets, and same with BTSX with its texture theming. Do you tend to sort of come up with a texture theme for the map first and then build from there, or now that you're blocking stuff out, do you find that it's a bit of a challenge not having a texture theme in mind like straight away?
Again, it kind of depends. Like, this was a case where I had basically no idea how I was going to texture it until I started actually putting stuff down in Doom Builder and applying textures there. But then, like, maps that I've done more recently for BTSX E3 have been, in some cases, like, I know that I want to do a certain theme for this, and it's just a question of, you know, it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to make this layout. I'm going to, like, make it as open as I can without, you know, without breaking vanilla, and then I'm going to just let future me figure out how to detail it without breaking the game.
Right.
But, like, as far as the Ancient Alien stuff, though, like, the architecture and the detailing style was definitely influenced by the resources, like, once I started doing the texturing.
Yeah.
But I would say a lot of the times I pick textures based on like what the map seems to need rather than the other way around. Like in BTSX E2, the secret map Fire King Says No Cheating, mm-hmm. like that was another map that got shadow ported, where like it was really struggling within vanilla limits. And so I actually, all the textures that are in that map, it's called the slab set. Like, I made those textures just for that map and for Dirty Water map 4, because like we had these big open areas that needed something really large scale so that it could look good without a ton of small detail.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I did want to ask you, as a bit of an aside, I think you made a lot of the textures that are featured in Stardate 20XD7. I'm not sure about 6 as well. I was curious about how those originally came about, because Rubix gave me a bunch of like leftover textures from that he hadn't used to use in Fracture Worlds, and I really loved working with that set. So I was just wondering about those.
I'm trying to remember exactly how that came about. Like, I think it was just Ribix and I were talking, and he asked if I could make some textures for him. Actually, maybe he was asking if he could use some of my existing textures, and I was like, actually, I don't want to release the BTSX stuff yet, but I can make you something new.
Right.
That might have been what happened.
Interesting. Yeah, because I love that texture set. And that was all original, like, built from scratch stuff in Photoshop as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So I wanted to talk about Vaporwave, which I guess is still a demo, but what made you want to try out the Eternity engine for Vaporwave?
So with Vaporware...
Oh, Vaporware, sorry. Yeah,
yes. I had been messing with stuff for Eternity engine since like the mid to late 2000s. And it's the main port that I use for playing Doom. And it's got a lot of cool features that don't really get utilized too often. So I just wanted to do something with it.
Right.
And now, like, at the time that I made that map, a lot of those features were kind of still in progress. So the ways that I could use them was somewhat limited, like compared to the amazing stuff that Skillsaw was doing in Heartland later on. But I mean, part of that is also just Skillsaw being amazing. But yeah, I just wanted to do some maps using those features. And now, originally, it was going to be a project with multiple mappers, but it was kind of hard wrangling people to get stuff done. And that was actually one of the big reasons why BTSX originally, I was setting my sights so low for it and saying, like, well, we'll just do a few maps and that'll be it.
Right.
But Vader has a really cool map that he did for Vaporware that I really hope that he will release someday.
Yeah, you'll have to do a summer 69 style, you know, release after the fact. You know, what's funny is I read the title Vaporware like 10 times when I was like looking at it, and I somehow still, my brain automatically filled in the blank there and just called it the wrong thing. So between like the music track and the Z-Doomisms and things that are employed extremely well in the Eternity engine, I thought there's some real like early 2000s vibes with this one, I felt like. In a good way. Were you trying deliberately to channel some of that with the one?
Not really. I think it was more just like I was still finding my style, I guess.
Right. Is it like definitely just going to stay how it is? You're not going to sort of bring it to a conclusion or anything and add more content to it?
Never say never. Like, I've got a few different projects that have been shelved for a while that I would be interested in coming back to at some point, and that's one of them.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like working in the Eternity engine then versus working with, like, other formats?
Well, being able to use portals was really cool just because, like, being able to do fully 3D stuff that was more complex than just like placing a 3D bridge in a room.
Mm-hmm.
Because like being able to have entire overlapping scenes without having to deal with like a million control sectors or whatever, that was something that you just, you know, at least at the time, there was no other port that could do something like that. So that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. There's that really cool, you have like a building on top of like this big piece of a mountain that's jutting out. You walk across this bridge and you can see it like off to your left. And that was like a very cool, specifically Eternity thing. And it doesn't feel, somehow it didn't feel like out of place in Doom, whereas a lot of this stuff can start to feel a little bit strange, like it should be in Quake or something. But yeah, I really liked that little set piece.
Thank you. Yeah, like that is actually an area that in one of the other Vaporware maps, you could actually like go up and visit that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was originally, like, I had a set of three maps within Vaporware that were originally going to be all one big map, but the scale got kind of out of control, so I ended up splitting it up into more than one map.
Right. And did you find that it was, like, a lot of work building a lot of that stuff and working with portals and things like that? Did it add a lot of, like, extra time onto the design phase?
That's kind of a tough question because all of my mapping was pretty slow back then.
Right.
But I mean, around that same time, I was also working on a bunch of stuff for ZDoom. And I feel like the main thing that was taking all the time was just I was doing a lot of pretty intricate detailing.
Yeah. A far cry from doing vanilla stuff, I would imagine. Being able to sort of just go crazy.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I'm really interested in getting back to making maps for source ports after BTSX E3 is done.
Right.
Just because I've been working on just vanilla stuff for the past, it's been like the last decade now, which is kind of crazy to think about. Because yeah. I was doing so much source port mapping, and then I thought, like, well, this would be fun to try in vanilla, and then I ended up just focusing totally on that for a while.
Right, yeah. The freeing experience of a Voodoo Doll Closet. It's gonna be exciting. So, I wanted to talk about Knee Deep in ZDoom. I got a very exclusive preview of this before it came out, which I was very excited about. And I knew it was going to be like this massive thing. I think you said just before you were kind of surprised by how big the reaction was, but I definitely knew it was going to be huge, based on what you'd shown me. So it's sort of described as like a demake of Knee Deep in ZDoom, which was a ZDoom feature laden recreation of the original iWard, basically. People who'd never played it. What was your goal with this project initially?
Well, when it started out, I was a teenager, and the original idea was pretty much just childish spite. Like, all of the hype and drama from Knee Deep in ZDoom was so fresh, and so I was like, well, I can show, you know, I'll show them, I'll do this. But then it kind of just became an interesting personal challenge to see how much I actually could do with just vanilla features.
Right.
It's like, when the project started, you know, I didn't know anyone who worked on KDIZD or anything like that. So it was just this sort of anonymous, faceless thing of like, oh, well, I'm going to rebel against this. But then over the years since then, I've gotten to know people like Vader and NMN. And, you know, so I would say that the spite that started the project was not there toward the end of it anymore.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about Knee Deep in ZDoom for people who don't know about it and where this spite might have come from?
So Knee Deep in ZDoom came out in 2007, and it had been hyped up a lot for a few years before then as like, this was going to be the greatest Doom thing since sliced bread. It's going to be amazing. It's going to do everything. And there was a lot of drama and conflict surrounding it. Like, at one point, somebody joined the project team just to leak the project, which is like a really dick move.
Wow.
But just like to give you an idea of how much drama there was surrounding this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the original E1 map expanded with a lot of new areas and with a lot of new detailing and architecture and a bunch of new monsters and stuff and lots and lots and lots of ZDoom features.
Yeah. Lots and lots. I remember very well. So there are a lot of like crazy tricks for vanilla that you implement to emulate the common sort of Z-Doomisms, like sloping and things like that. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those, and also, did you have like a list of features that you wanted to try to emulate at the beginning of the project?
Yeah, some of the things that I wanted to emulate early on kind of fell by the wayside just because there wasn't really a good way of doing them that wasn't just really janky, mm-hmm. like ambient sounds or bullet casings. But some of the things that did make it in, like probably my favorite feature that made it in was the camera textures.
Right, yep.
And that was something where, like, I had been thinking about it for a while and trying out different possibilities, and nothing was really working quite right. And I had actually, it was like 5 minutes after I had just given up on including them when the solution hit me. That's how it seems to go sometimes, where like I will rack my brains trying to come up with a way to solve something, and then I'll just give up on it. And then right after that, it's like, oh, that's how I can do it. So the whole idea of like, putting them on, like mapping them to a half cylinder instead of just putting them directly on the front window.
Mm-hmm.
Because that solved a bunch of problems at once, like being able to fit in more detail in the screen so that you could actually see what you're looking at, because, you know, it's a larger wall further away from you so you can see more. And also, like, having the lines all at angles meant that I was able to put the lines closer together with, you know, with the doom limit of not being able to go below the one unit grid.
Right.
Just because I could put stuff at angles. And so that made it possible to do all sorts of animations and stuff without it, like, looking obviously like lines are just popping up and down. But some other things that I did in there that I'm pretty proud of. One is the color palette. Like that, I got really hacky with the color palette.
Right.
Like I managed to squeeze in 38 Fulbright colors somehow. Like every time that I thought I was done finding spaces to fit in more Fulbright colors, I somehow managed to find more.
Right.
So like there's Fulbright, white and gray, tan, red, yellow, blue, green, orange, like just ramp from each of those. So that allowed for a lot of lighting detail that I would have otherwise not really been able to do in vanilla.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But then there was another even weirder trick that was like, in the Dehacked Patches comments, I jokingly called it Baron Heist 451.
Right. Where,
so the Baron and the Hell Knight, they're using basically the same sprites, but just recolored. And what I did was, like, because Doom has these flags that you can use in Dehacked for recoloring, like, normally it's just, like, turning the Doom guy sprites green into, like,
gray, brown, red,
gray or brown or red. Yeah. So what I did was I rearranged the palette a whole bunch so that I would be able to start with the Baron's like flesh pink color and turn it into tan or gray or green.
Uh-huh.
Using those same flags so that I could basically that allowed me to fit in several more monsters than I would have been able to otherwise. Because, like, the Nightmare Demon also uses that same trick.
That's really cool. That's, I mean, it's that kind of, like, very esoteric stuff that I feel like people wouldn't even notice in this ward, but it seems like you put, like, a huge amount of effort into it.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing where it was just, like, I thought of it, and I was like, oh god, that would be such a pain in the ass to do, except then, like, I kept thinking, like, but I could do it. I could do it, though.
Yeah.
And so eventually I just gave in and tried it, and I was surprised that it actually worked.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you have those moments when you're mapping where you're like, like, you think, like, oh, I could do this thing. I feel like it is usually, yeah, like, vanilla or boom or something, and then you're like, but it would be hideously time consuming. But if I did it, it would be really cool. So then you end up having to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like I do not know how to say no to that voice.
Yeah, right. Well, clearly, because this world is kind of insane in the stuff that it does. So the water is obviously meant to be, like, satirical to an extent. And it seems... But it sort of seems that you tried to find, like, a balance with still making it sort of, like, you know, fun to play, a proper gameplay experience. Which maybe came a bit later when the spite dissipated, but, did you find that was a bit of a challenge to sort of straddle the line between, like, joke WoD and sort of, I don't know, proper WoD, I guess?
I don't know if the jokiness was really a challenge, but one thing that was a challenge, I guess, relating to that was just taking the existing layouts and adapting them into something that could accommodate the kind of gameplay that I wanted it to have.
Right.
Because Knee Deep in Zedium has a lot of choke points. It has a lot of, like, shooting monsters with a lot of HP right in front of you. And I really wanted to have, like, breezier combat, so I added a lot of barrels, I reduced a lot of meat, and I wanted to have just things that could challenge and surprise the player mixed in there.
Right, so there was never really, like... You felt like parodying the gameplay itself would probably take it to the point where it's like, well, this WoD would just become bad to play. So it was more, you wanted sort of visual jokes and things like that, and then keep the gameplay to, like, actually being enjoyable.
Definitely, yeah. And I would say that was something that was a goal pretty much from the beginning. Just, like, I wanted to make sure that it was actually fun to play, because just...
Yeah.
I don't know. I just... It felt like if I was going to make this and it wasn't going to be fun, then, like, what was the point? So I did a lot of work trying to, like, cut down on confusion in Z1M3 by, like, removing extra quests and connecting more areas to each other, and then, like... When all else failed, I added some signposting with, like, fake BBS posts. Mm-hmm. With, like, people talking about where they can find their keys that they lost.
Right.
Or, like, removing a lot of backtracking in Z1M7, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I find it funny that it was Z1M7. I don't know. To me, there's a bit of hubris to giving it its own initial, but it's just... I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your other projects as well, which, you know, I feel like a lot of them are tangentially related to Doom, especially in terms of, like, Supplice, which you're working on the music for, which I know at least Mechadon and Zazer, I believe, are also working on it. How has working on music for that project been different than making music for your Doom projects?
Well, it's been different in a few ways. Like, one big way is that I'm not just writing MIDIs for it, but doing, like, full productions for it. So that, you know, that makes for a lot more work, but I think it can also make for better results.
Yeah.
And I've also been, as part of that, I've been taking MIDIs by Jimmy and adapting those to full productions while also writing some of my own tracks.
Interesting.
And I would say that, like, oh, I'm sorry.
No, you go.
I would say that probably the biggest challenge with it is just figuring out the right direction for each track, since just, like, when you're covering a MIDI, it's, you know, the obvious direction is to go, like, okay, well, there's strings here, so I'm going to use strings here. There's guitar here, so I'm going to use guitar here. But if you just use, like, generic sounds like that, then it kind of ends up just sounding like you took a MIDI and ran it through a sound font, which was something that I really didn't want for this. Like, I wanted it to sound like these tracks were written as full productions in the first place.
Right. And is there some sense of also, like, this is a commercial release, or do you feel like the pressure isn't any different because when you make stuff for Doom, you're still trying to make stuff for the highest quality anyway?
I mean, as always, I'm just trying to make something that I feel is good enough to satisfy myself, because, like, I tend to go through a lot of revisions of things as I just... I don't know, I can be pretty hard on my own work.
Right. as any creative person can be, I think.
Definitely, yeah.
Is it cool to work with people like Mech and Zazer on something like this that's sort of outside of Doom and maybe feels like a bit of an evolution of like where you sort of began as like level designers and stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really glad that I got to be part of that.
Yeah, it's definitely cool to see. I'm excited for like the full release and stuff.
Me too. I hope people will like it.
Well, good feedback on the demo, I think. I remember seeing Vile play through it and a few other people, and it looked like everyone was enjoying it, so exciting to see that all coming together. Also, just to touch on it quickly, you've got a visual novel out as well. Please Be Happy, I think it's called, which has an original soundtrack that you composed. So, like, obviously Supplies is, like, outside of Doom, but it still has, like, quite a lot of similarities to it in gameplay, and, you know, it's in the GZ Doom engine and stuff. I was curious what it was like to make music for a game that's just, like, completely different from Doom.
Well, I mean, I've been composing since 2003, and Doom has just been, like, one small part of that.
Sure, yeah.
So, just Please Be Happy is, God, I think it's the sixth released game soundtrack that I've done.
Whoa, okay.
I have a few others in the works, just all in different styles. Like, I've done Vaporwave, I've done Rock, Orchestral, Folk, and for one, I did MIDI for, like, a Super Nintendo-style kind of game. So, I don't know, I just love making music in general, and visual novels are nice because I get to cover, like, a lot of emotional range without having to make it all dark or action-packed like Doom tracks.
Yeah.
Because, like, with BTSX, like, with the track Lost City from E2, I just remember early on when I was working on that, I just kept feeling like, I have to change this and make it stop sounding like RPG Town music. This is for Doom.
RPG Town music is one of my favorite genres of music, I'll be honest.
Nice.
Well, I suppose you sort of touched on it, considering you've clearly worked on a lot of other things, but I was wondering if there was sort of, with a visual novel, are there certain specific challenges in terms of, like, certain tonal or, like, pacing differences from what you're used to?
Yeah, I would say that, like, music for reading a story to is generally, it's different from making music for playing an action game to, mm-hmm. because, like, it has to be still interesting and detailed enough that you can enjoy hearing it on loop for a while, but it also can't be too busy and distracting that it's going to, like, annoy you while you're trying to read.
Right.
But, I don't know, I mean, it's fun to write, because I just really love a lot of visual novel music and anime music, which is kind of, like, similar styles.
Mm-hmm. You should make a Doom mod that just uses that kind of tone instead, and see what kind of maps you end up coming up with.
That could be interesting, I guess.
Or just make a Doom visual novel, you know. I think someone already did that, didn't they?
I think so, yeah.
It was like a dating sim for Doom.
Oh my god. Yeah, wait. I was at, I think the first thing that came to mind for me when you mentioned that was Mr. Friendly by JPL, where it was like, it's a Z-Doom mod where you go around talking to the monsters, like based on that old Doom review where somebody was like, well, why can't you just talk out your differences?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure if that was the one I was thinking of. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think somebody did make an actual visual novel in Doom, though, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it ever got, like, fully finished. I think there was, like, a demo version, but I don't think it had all the monsters in it. Didn't have all the great dating routes you could go down. Or routes, depending. To wrap it all up with the final question that I ask everybody, what is your favorite Doom monster, and why?
This is probably too basic of an answer or too obvious of an answer, but the Archvile and the Revenant are my favorites because they're just always fun to fight. I really love how Archviles can, like, change up the rhythm of a fight and just force the player to engage differently, because, like, when mm-hmm. you have one there, it just immediately kind of puts you in panic mode.
Yeah.
And Revenants are just a great all-rounder. I missed both of those a lot when I was working on KDI, KDI ZD, because it doesn't have the Doom 2 monsters. But right. It did have Dark Cacos, and I liked those a lot. Those were fun, because they're like flying arachnotrons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting you talk about rhythm with a vial, because they do sort of add that to a fight. Like, if you have a pillar that you have to duck behind, and suddenly you have to react to the timing of the flame specifically, and it definitely just completely changes how you have to move in a fight.
Right, plus you can't just, like, easily run away and deal with them later, because they're just going to resurrect everything if you leave them alone for too long.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of elements to them that... I think a lot of people choose the Archvile because it is just, like, extremely unique to Doom. Like, the fact that it's fire is hit scan, the way that it functions anyway. The weird, like, intricacies of their targeting range, where if you hit them, suddenly their range is, like, you know, close to infinite or whatever. There are just a lot of, like, small nuances with the Archvile that you just don't see in monsters from other games, so definitely a stellar choice. And then the Revenant as well. Also very versatile. Do you think you could pick between the two of them? Would there be one that you would prefer over the other?
I mean, I guess if I had to, like, only have one of them, I would say the Revenant, just because they're such a good all-rounder.
Yeah. That's true. I suppose I think I might actually choose the Vial, just because... you can at least get some sort of projectile dodging gameplay out of other enemies, but you can never get what the Vial offers from other enemies, so...
That's true.
It's a tough call, though. God, not having Revenants in a map? Brutal. well, anyway, thank you so much for being on. It was great to talk to you. Really interesting insights into BTSX and all your other projects. Yeah, I really enjoyed your album, too. I recommend people go and listen to that on Spotify and stuff. And, yeah, just sort of overly impressed by your body of work for Doom. Textures, MIDI, a lot of really good maps, just a constant presence in the Doom community, and yeah, very talented. So, yeah, thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, no worries. And maybe, yeah, who knows, in the future, I keep saying I might have people back, we'll see. But yeah, in the future, if you're open to that, it could be a possibility.
Sure. Maybe once I've got some other things released, whenever that happens.
Yeah, well, when BTSX 4 comes out in 10 years.
Oh my god.
Still working in vanilla limits 10 years later.
No. If there is more BTSX after E3, it's not going to be for vanilla. That's one thing that's decided.
That's interesting. You heard it here first, folks. that'll wrap this one up with that little tidbit. And I'll be back next week with another guest. Thank you again to Essel. And goodbye.
Thank you.